As I mentioned last Sunday, over April we're going to be looking at some post-Easter stories. And last Sunday, Simon was preaching on the story of the road to Emmaus. And as I was thinking about that and preparing for that and thinking about this today, going, okay, what do I do? You know, it's very tempting to dust off an old sermon and to pull one out of the bag that I've done before, particularly when it's been a long week and it's tiring and it's just like, I can't, yeah, okay. But I think I preached on every story post-Easter in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, apart from this one. So we're going to do this one this morning. That's what I felt God say to me. So this is a fresh sermon, not an old rehashed one, based on this story. And I'm going to link it into these verses in Matthew 28, verses 11 to 15. But in order to get the context of that, we're going to jump back into the story from Matthew 27 and verse 62. So this is at the end of chapter 27, verse 62, in Matthew's account, this is what it says. The next day. Okay, let me pause just there for a moment, because that's really significant. What was the next day? What happened the day before this? Crucifixion. Okay. What happened on this day? What's the next day then? It was the Saturday. It was the what? Sabbath. Okay. Now that's really significant because of what happens next. Okay. So this is on the Sabbath this happens. The next day, the one after preparation day, i.e. the Sabbath, the chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate. The religious leaders of the day who had berated Jesus for healing on the Sabbath, for picking a bit of corn on the Sabbath. On the Sabbath, they went to Pilate. They worked. They broke the Sabbath rules. Why? Because they were so desperate to get this sorted. This is really important for them. Okay. So let's hear that. Let's receive that. Let's understand what's going on here. Okay. The next day, the one after preparation day, the Sabbath, the chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate. Sir, they said, we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver said, after 3 days, I will rise again. So give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, the disciples may come and steal the body and tell the people that he has been raised from the dead. This last deception will be worse than the first. Take a guard, Pilate answered. Go make the tomb as secure as you know how. So they went and made the tomb secure by putting a seal on the stone and posting the guard. After the Sabbath, at dawn, on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb. There was a violent earthquake, for an angel of the Lord came down from heaven and, going to the tomb, rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothes were white as snow. The guards were so afraid of him that they shook and became like dead men. The angel said to the woman, do not be afraid, for I know that you are looking for Jesus who was crucified. He's not here, he's risen, just as he said. Come and see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples, he's risen from the dead and is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him. Now I have told you. So the women hurried away from the tomb, afraid, yet filled with joy, and ran to tell his disciples. Suddenly Jesus met them. Greetings, he said. They came to him, clasped his feet and worshipped him. Then Jesus said to them, do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There they will see me. While the women were on their way, some of the guards went into the city and reported to the chief priests everything that had happened. When the chief priests had met with the elders and devised a plan, they gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, you are to say, his disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep. If this report gets to the governor, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble. So the soldiers took the money and did as they were instructed. And this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day. Last year, I did preach on this particular section, as you can all well remember, can't you? Matthew 28, verses 1 through to 17 is what I preached on last post-Easter Sunday. But these last few verses, I just want to focus in on for a few moments this morning, verses 11 through to 15. Why? Because I think they have something significant for us to hear in the context of all that we've been doing as a church over these last few weeks and months. But before we do that, let's just ask ourselves the question, why does Matthew include this story here? He's the only one that includes this story. So why does he do it? What's the reason for this? Matthew's gospel account was written for the Jews. It was written for a Jewish audience. And it was clear at the time of him writing this letter that the word on the street was what? That the disciples had stolen the body. He says it there. This story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day. The Jewish word on the street was the disciples stole the body. So when Matthew's writing his account, he wants to challenge that. He wants to bring an apologetic. He wants to argue and rationally argue that that isn't true. He wants his Jewish readers to think about it. If you don't think about it, well, okay, the disciples stole the body. Yeah, it makes sense. Does it really make sense? Stop and think about it. He's asking his Jewish readers to stop and ponder and ask themselves the questions. So he puts this story in. Now, who told Matthew this story? Because Matthew wouldn't have known this story. So it's probable, and we can only surmise, it's probable that one of the soldiers at some point converted and was able to tell Matthew exactly what had happened, an inside account. The passage at the end of chapter 27. Now, if this story is a true story, and Matthew's putting it out there as a true story, then it cannot be that Jesus' disciples stole the body. The story only makes sense for Matthew to include it if it's true, and it only makes sense if the guards didn't actually fall asleep. If they had fallen asleep, how would they have known everything that happened? Well, they wouldn't, because they were asleep. The guards put there were put there for a reason. These guards were not just any old guard. They were Pilate's guard. They were Roman soldiers. And for them to fall asleep on duty wouldn't have ended well for them. This is a Christian apologetic by Matthew that only makes sense if it's true. It only makes sense for Matthew to include it, to get his Jewish audience to think about it, to go, yeah, we haven't really thought that through, have we? Yeah, okay, the guards couldn't have fallen asleep. Therefore, there must be another story. There must be another reason for what happened. There must be another explanation for the empty tomb. So that's why Matthew includes it. He wants his readers, he wants us as his readers, okay, we're not Jewish, but he wants us as well, to go, okay, there's an empty tomb. What's the reason for that? What's the explanation for that? And then he gives us the account of how Jesus has risen from the dead. Having established why the story's there, I want to focus on two journeys. Because there were two journeys that are described in verses 11 through to 15. They both start at the empty tomb. They both start with the same story. But they take very different journeys and very different paths. First of all, we have the women. These ladies had come to pay their respects to Jesus. They had waited the Sabbath. They had observed the Sabbath, unlike the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They had observed the Sabbath. They had prepared their spices on the preparation day. They'd waited. And as soon as they could, as early as they could, the earliest opportunity, they hot-footed down to the garden to pay their respects. They probably haven't thought through how they're going to get in at this point, how they're going to break in and open and move a stone and all the rest of it. But they just knew they needed to go. They just knew that that's where they needed to be. For some reason, they just knew that. And having found the tomb empty and being told by the angel to go away, what happens? They went away, but they were afraid and yet filled with joy. So these women who started at the empty tomb, they've met an angel, they've had this encounter, they've seen the empty tomb, and they leave the garden full of fear, but also a sense of joy. And what happens? They go and Jesus meets them. And he says to them, "Do not be afraid." Hands up if you've ever been fearful. Okay. If I say to you, "Don't be afraid," does it immediately go? Right. Okay. So these women, Jesus says to them, "Don't be afraid." What do? They carry on being afraid, right? Doesn't immediately go. They carry on still being afraid, but it just starts to lessen perhaps, where they reflect on who Jesus is, they reflect on the story. We read our Bibles and it says, "Do not be afraid, do not fear, do not fear, do not worry." What do? We worry, we're fearful, aren't we? Yeah? We read it, we know it. Does it change us immediately? No. It only changes us as we allow God to change us, as we allow it to really seep in, as Judas said, from our head to our hearts, really to grab hold of us. It doesn't immediately change everything. These women would have continued their journey fearful, yet filled with joy. That's the first journey. The second journey is the guards. Now, we don't know much about what happened to them after this, do we? But what happened is they were at the tomb. Matthew describes an earthquake, an angel sitting on a tomb, moving the stone, empty tomb, and they are what? How do you describe him? What does it say again? They shook and became like dead men. Okay. One can assume that they were quite frightened. Okay. So the guard had come from Pilate. These were Roman soldiers. And having encountered whatever they encountered, they went and reported everything to the chief priests. They wouldn't have gone back to Pilate in the barracks, because what would have happened to there if they had gone back to the barracks and told them what happened? Wouldn't have ended well for them. So they went to the chief priests. And they too were fearful. They've seen the earthquake. They've seen the angel. They've seen the stone rolled away. They've seen the empty tomb. They've seen the angel sat on the stone. And they've become like dead men. Their journey started in that same place. And they went full of fear. They went to the Jewish leaders. Two journeys. Same story, different responses. These two groups of people, they both witnessed the same events. Okay, the women didn't witness the earthquake, but they saw the angel, and the angel spoke to them. They saw the empty tomb. They'd also all been part of the whole thing over the weekend. They'd seen what happened the day before. The Roman soldiers probably were involved, certainly in the beatings of Jesus. They would have certainly been part of the group that would have been seen him crucified. The women watched everything. So that whole weekend, both groups of people knew what had happened. Both groups had been around for the trial, seen the crucifixion, the body taken off, the empty tomb, all of that. They'd both witnessed the whole story. But their responses were very different. Although actually, maybe they weren't so different. Both, you see, experienced real fear. Both the women and the soldiers were afraid. They were afraid of different things, but fear gripped them. Fear made the soldiers like they were dead men. For the women, what were they fearful of? The uncertainty of what was their life now. They'd given up 3 years to follow Jesus around. He'd been their kind of Lord. He'd been their master. He'd been the one that they'd followed. And now he's gone. What does this mean for us? Uncertainty over the future. Perhaps a level of personal safety. Are they going to come after us now? Are we going to be the next to be hung on a cross? A mix of joy and fear, because they had experienced the risen Jesus, but they had no idea what this was going to mean for them. And even though Jesus had said to them, do not be afraid, the fear would have still been there. For the soldiers, their reputation was on the line. They were sent as Roman soldiers to guard this tomb, to make sure what had happened didn't happen. Very explicitly. Your job, soldiers, is to make sure that body stays in that tomb. One job, and they couldn't do it. So their reputation's on the line. A sense of failure. Ultimately, life, if the Roman governor finds out, if Pilate finds out, if our boss finds out, centurion, we're a goner. Fear. What are you afraid of? It lies at the heart of so much of our struggles. It might be fear of flying, or health, or spiders, or snakes, or the dark. And those things are real. But what about fear of rejection? What about fear of failure? What about fear of the future? Fear of what is going to happen tomorrow? Fear of the unknown? And we read our Bibles and we see time and time again, God say to us, do not be afraid. And does it make any difference? Well, it kind of does, but it doesn't really kind of take it away, does it? But how they respond to what they do makes a difference with how they handle their fear. This week, Anne Calver, who some of us remember from last year when she came to speak here, and she's going to come later this year to do our Catherine's induction service. Anne is a friend of us here, and she understands what we're about, and she's kind of really she prays for us and is encouraging us, part of Catherine's support group as well. She shared a prophetic word on a platform, on a video. And in the context of that, it's the word that she felt was for the church in our nation at this time. In that prophetic word, she says this: fear won't die until idolatry is put to death. Fear won't die until idolatry is put to death. She said it twice. That's a prophetic word which Anne shared, which I'm bringing to you this morning. This is a prophetic word that I believe is from God for us, but it's also for our church nationally. Fear won't die until idolatry is put to death. What is idolatry? What do we understand by that? And Anne, in unpacking that, quoted a song. Anything I put before my God is an idol. Anything I want with all my heart is an idol. Anything I can't stop thinking of is an idol. Anything I give all my love is an idol. That's idolatry. Anything that comes before God. Fear won't die until idolatry is put to death. The women, they fear what is coming. They fear the future. They wonder what life might look for them and for the disciples. But they met Jesus. The soldiers, fearful for their reputations and their lives, didn't meet Jesus? How do we deal with fear in our lives? How do you deal with fear? And it may not be that fear of the dark or that fear of flying. It may be when you actually ask yourself what's really going on, it is a fear of rejection. And that could be rooted in years and years of story. As Steve said earlier, you know, that our past does have a long shadow. And your past might well be the thing that kind of leaves you that sense of fear. Fear of the unknown. Fear of the uncertainty of what's coming next. Two groups of people. They have the same story. They have the same experiences. But one group met with Jesus and one group didn't. Now, we can sit through the same services. We can listen to the same sermons. We can go to the same places. We can hear the same encouragements of what God is doing. We can hear all of that stuff, and we can see all the stuff. Doesn't change it necessarily. Doesn't change the idolatry in our lives. It's our hearts that God is after. The same story. Fear. Secondly, both groups were searching for answers. Both groups wanted to know what was happening, why things had happened. Both were trying to make sense of what they were experiencing, what they'd witnessed. And as we go through life, we will experience all sorts of different things. And it's right and proper that we try to make sense of those things. The problem for the guards is, what do? Who did they turn to? They turned to people who were self-seeking, who had an ulterior motive, who had an agenda, who would say what they wanted them to say. They knew that the only people that were going to back them up were the Jewish leaders. The Roman leaders wouldn't have done it. The disciples wouldn't have done it. Their family probably wouldn't have done it. The only people that were going to back them up, say what they wanted to hear, were the Jewish leaders. Why? Because the Jewish leaders had an interest. They had an own agenda. How true is it for us? In searching for answers, we can turn to the wrong people. Turn to people that will, they're us. Will agree with us, won't challenge us, will back us up. Why? Because actually they are quite comfortable just sitting on the fence. Who do we turn to when we're searching and trying to find answers? Like some of you, I have a number of friends on social media who people from this community who we connected with over, you know, during lockdown, and they kind of friends requested me, and so I kind of agreed, you know, like you do. And now I see all their posts. I've got one in particular who, you know, she's having a hard time. It's the one on social media. What does she do? Well, how does she process? How does she, when she's searching for answers, what does she do? Puts up a post. Who do we turn to? Who do you turn to help you to make sense of what you're going through? People that are going to back you up and they're you. Or people that are going to bring you the challenge and say, do you know what? Maybe you need to think through this. Now, when we turn to the right people, when we turn to God, the reality is, if you're honest, God doesn't often give us the answers, which is probably perhaps why we don't ask him. And I was reminded of the Apostle Paul, who had a thorn in his side. We don't know what that thorn was. It could have been a health condition. It could have been something else. We don't know. But there was some issue for Paul, and he kind of cried out to God for this to be taken away from him, for him to be relieved of this burden that he carried. And what did God say to him? He didn't say, okay, yeah, I'll do it for you. What he said was, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Maybe there's a verse there for another month. My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. He doesn't say to Paul, I'll take it away. He doesn't say to Paul, this is why you've got it. What he does for Paul is he redirects his vision. He redirects his perspective and he says, you're looking at the wrong stuff. Look to me. Look to me. In those moments when we're searching for answers, let's look to Jesus. Let's seek God first. That's the death of idolatry. Seeking God becomes the most important thing in our lives. As we close, I just want to draw it to a conclusion and apply this into what we've been looking at over these last weeks and months. Both of these groups of people, the women and the guards, they witnessed the same story. They were exposed to the same truth. One group responded well and one group didn't. One group felt fear. They had questions and they were worried about their future. But they turned to Jesus and responded in obedience. One group felt fear, had questions, and were worried about their future. But they turned to self-absorbed people and responded by lives that were masked by deceit. They were paid off. And they lived their lives deceitful. A lie, living a lie. How do we respond to the truth? You know, we've been challenged over recent weeks and months with a whole bunch of stuff. What we believe, the truths of the gospel, the truths of what it is that we teach, the truths of the Bible. What are we doing with it? Catherine, a few weeks ago, challenged us again about the story of the cross and the resurrection and how we have been saved. Have we really allowed that to take hold of our hearts, to motivate us, to stir us? Have we really allowed it to sink in? Is it still up here or is it down here? If it's up here, it makes no difference to our lives whatsoever. If it's here, we feel the burden that we, as we've been saying in recent weeks, that we've got a world around us that are lost, who need Jesus. And if you don't feel it, I would question whether you've allowed that truth to sink from here to here. What do we do with the truth? How do you respond to the truth of God's word? We have a choice. We can be like the women, who though fearful, though we've got questions, though we're worried about our futures, though we have lots of uncertainty, we turn to Jesus. Or we could be like the guards, who experience exactly the same stuff. They just look to people that weren't going to challenge them. Let them live lives of deceit, pay them off, live comfortable lives. Do we have idols in our lives that are more important to us than God? Let's pray.